I'm Paul Tenorio. I cover soccer for The Athletic.
And I'm Amy Lawrence. I cover football for The Athletic.
Whatever you call it, the biggest competition in the sport is happening right now. And The Athletic's World Cup coverage has everything you need to follow the tournament.
We've got more than 70 obsessive reporters on the ground. If you're eager to know more about the teams, the matches, all the stories on and off the pitch, we've got you sorted.
Throughout the tournament, you have free access to all the coverage in our app.
Download The Athletic app and see you there.
Paying someone to rhinestone like a bodysuit for you is...
Oh, it's the labor. It's not the stone itself.
Well, it's the labor and the stones. Okay. The crystals themselves are expensive.
The quality of the stone. You got to get a good
stone. Yeah, you got to get the good quality.
Yeah.
Like the nice ones.
Yeah.
The Austrian Preciosa Maxima crystals, you know?
Wow.
Preciosa, if you're listening, please send me rhinestones. I can't keep doing this.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your We Should Link Later of Weekly Culture Chat. I'm John Caramonica. I'm the critic.
I'm Joe Coscarelli. I am the reporter.
I'm Slater, and I'm on podcast.
There we go. Worst girl in America in the building.
Yeah.
But you're here every week.
that was good. We didn't even set that one up. That was just,
freestyle.
Rim shot off the dome. Slater is an overnight sensation, 10 years in the making.
Yeah.
One of the breakout pop stars of the year so far. I think we can trace this year back to the sort of 1-2 punch of you releasing this album, Worst Girl in America, performing a breakout set at both weekends of Coachella. You performed on the Jimmy Fallon show. You played your hit Dance. You went all out.
Yeah.
Costume, choreo. When did you know, it's finally happening, this thing I've been yearning and reaching for?
I think the reception on Beat Up Chanel's, even though that was pretty early on, that was the first single from this project. People really loved that right off the bat, and I wasn't really expecting them to like it so much, but I had just signed with records in Colombia a little bit before. So I knew I was able to make kind of like proper videos for this album and wasn't really able to do that on projects previously. But this whole album, like making it like in 2024, before the signing conversations even came into play, I was felt like my career was kind of done. I was like, you know what? This isn't really working. I'm losing money on tours. It's so expensive to be like a small range artist, like buying merch and getting your name out there. And I had like a really big crisis happen with an old merch company that owed money on like merch I had made, which was like crucial to use for touring and all these different things. For me, it was like, I needed that so bad, not only to like pay the people that I work with, but to like get on the road. Like it's so expensive to tour. It's unreal. The numbers of like renting buses and doing all these things, like it's really hard. So that was like a huge turning point where I was just like this, like, oh my gosh, it was just thing after thing. I came home from Christmas at St. Louis and like all this merch was like lining my hallway because we were lucky enough to get our stuff out of the warehouse before it was like seized. It was like really bad. Wow. Yeah. But I felt so over it all. And it just was like all these things getting knocked down. And so I made this album from a place of like, all right, if I die tomorrow and this is my last piece of art that I leave in the world, what would I want to say? What would I want it to sound like? What would I be proud of? Would I want to make kind of like pop dance floor music? No, not really. Like I want to make stuff that I would have thought was cool when I was in high school and like has a bit of like punk electronic in it, has a bit of distortion and dirty elements and feels like it hits home for me.
And that's a genre that you've, I think, cleverly called iPod music.
Yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about what iPod music entails, because I find it to be very evocative because we're not that far in age, but I think some people maybe are calling it indie sleaze, but I think this is a better term.
What
is iPod music?
Definitely a better term than indie sleaze. That's for damn sure. Yep. But I think to me, indie sleaze is such a different thing. That feels like a very like micro trend internet resurgence of like early aughts more than just music. To me, like iPod music is almost a more like eclectic collection of songs that were popular around that time. So it's not just like the cool indie stuff. It's also like, I don't know, having like U2 music on your iPod.
Right. That wasn't an option.
Forcibly.
Yeah. Well, but not even, no, I'm that's you so proactive, funny. You, I love U2. Okay. I'm a huge U2 fan.
Protect U2.
Protect you. No, How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb inspired my album actually a lot. Like everyone at that time too would usually share like iTunes in their household. So it'd be like a little, like some Beach Boys stuff from my mom and then like Lil Wayne from my sister. And then like I would download Just Dance by Lady Gaga or Hung Up by Madonna would be really big during that time, or songs from Coldplay or MIA or Santa Gold. I just remember discovering music at that age, and it was so click purchase for like a dollar on a song, and you would very intentionally put the things that you liked on your iPod, and then if you went to school, that's all you had. You didn't have everything at your fingertips. Not everything was at your disposal. Mm-hmm. It wasn't so convenient to listen to music because there was no streaming at the time. So I just really started to get such a love for that like time period. And like, I wanted to make something that felt nostalgic for those sounds, but I didn't want to just do it like it was done. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like in the studio, we would like borrow little influences from random shit, whether it was like the White Stripes or Space Cowboys production on the Fame or different things here and there. And it made like this Frankenstein sound that feels like, I don't know what else to say other than like, it feels like iPod music.
You also said something in an interview like many years ago, you were talking about the early to mid 2000s and you said, I love the flop pop stars of that era, like Heidi Montag's pop career.
Oh, well, she's not a flop.
These are your
words. She's a star.
Not time anymore. To reclaim this.
Well,
and he said it inspired you to make tacky songs that are just fun. But I wonder if you can talk about the difference between like serious music and unserious music. And do you think that there's a gap there, or do you think that that's like a false dichotomy?
I think there is a gap because people don't know how to blend the two or maybe appreciate the two for what they are. I hate pretentiousness. I really hate pretentiousness with music. I feel like Nadia Oh is a great example. She is someone who, I think Space Cowboy, who was like a producer on the Fame largely at the beginning of Gaga's career, he produced all of this music for this artist, Nadia Oh. And so she has all these like great songs, but she didn't really like continue with the pop star thing. So if you will, sorry to Nadia Oh, she's like out there listening somewhere, but a flop, a flop pop star, if you will, but it.
You're going to make people rediscover.
Yeah.
But the move.
Yeah. But it's, the music is so fun and the production is actually so sick because it was Space Cowboy who he's like disappeared. No one really knows where he is anymore, but I just think that her songs would be like getting high in Amsterdam, like getting crazy because we can't. Music is loud. Girls in the window. Amsterdam is for the win, yo. At face value, people would probably listen to that and be like, oh, this isn't like deep and this doesn't really touch on anything important. But I don't know. I think that when you hear that song in like a club setting or when you're like drunk with a friend playing it at an afters, you have like a visceral reaction just like you would anything else.
Also, I think one of the things that's interesting is like when in that era specifically, like if Heidi Montag put out a record, if Lindsay Lohan, Paris Hilton, Farrah Abraham, I think about the Farrah Abraham.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I think about the
sick poll.
Yeah, but when I think about those albums, what's fascinating is the stakes of those albums are so different than a Lady Gaga album or a Britney or Christina album. And therefore, they're riskier. Mm-hmm. Weirder things are happening on those albums. Huh. And because of that, maybe not every weird thing sticks, but one or two things, you're like, damn, no one has done whatever this is, this like production gesture, this vocal effect, so on and so forth. And then those end up being things that influence artists of purpose and seriousness. They say, oh, okay, like, that's an influence.
Yeah, I think aspiring artists know how to
pull
from forgotten, lost art, right? Like, I think, like, Dylan Brady of 100 Gex is definitely, like, pulling from some of this discard pile. Like, someone like yourself, like, do you feel like that's part of your purpose as an artist to take things that have been disrespected in the past and put a new sheen on them to have them reconsidered? Do you think about it in those terms?
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes it's not so thought out in that way. Like things without me even referencing it directly, things just kind of stick in my body or in my mind almost subconsciously.
Yeah.
Like things that I grew up listening to, things I loved growing up. But yeah, I think that there's something that's been happening recently. I call it like taste peacocking, and it really makes me annoyed. You know, like the performative, like people will name like niche bands and niche things. Yeah. And it's great to like those things. There's nothing wrong with having like good taste, but I feel like now people taste peacock so crazy. And like, it's okay to be like, oh my God, I love Lindsay Lohan's first album.
There was a clip of you recently where you were asked for your Holy Trinity or your top three pop albums.
The Fame, Blackout, Britney, and probably Beat It.
And some people were like, oh, duh, like these are the obvious ones. And then I think there was some pushback in the conversation that was like, there's no shame in naming three of the great pop albums of the 21st century.
I almost sounded off on Twitter, but I was like, let me not today. Just because if someone asks you, what are your three like favorite pop albums? Wouldn't you name like big female culture shifting on the radio pop albums? Like, could you, this is back to the taste peacocking thing. If I sat there and I was like, oh, I love like Little Peach Fuzz and the Two Shoes and they're and they're not, fuck off, like, oh my god, like, no, it's it's music that was huge when I was young. Like, to me, that's the Trinity. I don't really like pull from any of those things like so directly. Of course in ways I do, but like I don't even think my like Worst Girl in America sounds like anything of the sort. But people were being so annoying about those choices, and I was like, if you don't hear a little like Ring the Alarm on like Crank, or you don't hear a little like, those are great. There's like music within those albums that people aren't even thinking of because they just take it at face value.
Because they're so big that they almost cease to exist as actual intricate pieces of art.
Yeah.
This is the thing. I think when you're talking about taste peacocking, a lot of what you're talking about is someone being like, I know so much, I've thought so, I've listened so widely that I've actually landed at this incredibly obscure thing to prove that I've done the work. But they forget that you had to start as a 7-year-old, 9-year-old, 11-year-old.
Anyone who says they were listening to Death Grips when they were 12, you're lying.
Or if they're not lying, what's your life like? Are you okay?
Do you need help? I don't think it's the right
Should we send help?
Or you probably have like really cool parents, or like someone, like not everyone has that. Sometimes you have to, it's a, it's a path of discovery. It's a path of discovery that takes a lifetime to kind of discover what you like. And it's okay to not know things. It's okay to not be privy to things that are really popular, or like maybe not popular, but cool, or like respected in like certain scenes. Like, it's okay to discover those things and love them.
Like what you like.
My favorite quote is like early Gaga, like the Fame, like when she was just starting to debut, she like had this video, and on her glasses, she had these video glasses, and it said like, pop music will never be lowbrow. And I think to that, when everyone's like, those are your three albums, it's like, yes.
Yeah.
Proudly so.
Those are pop albums.
Yeah. So take us back. You're talking about this moment. You're really up against the ropes, like bank account low after the merch debacle. But you're starting to make this album. And then you're also getting these nibbles of interest. Like, what did you learn from serious music business interest in your career at that transitional moment where you were almost ready to give up?
It was nice to have people interested at all. And I think it actually kind of switched my brain around. Like, before the album even came out, I was like, oh, maybe like being 29 isn't a death sentence, and maybe like I can give this another shot. Obviously, I wasn't signing my deal being like, no, this is still going to be my last album, because that's not how that works. But I think it made me think differently just about everything, and differently about what I want and where I want to go. Within like making this project, I feel like I rediscovered my love for making music so, so much. I can't imagine a day where I would ever not want to make music anymore. I think I was just really depressed and like beaten down by everything, that I was getting into that headspace of like, this is my last album. Like, fuck this, man. I'm going back to St. Louis. But I think having Columbia and Records reach out and be so interested, knowing that like I have kind of had a career that has been a bit tepid for a while and not, you know, like I was like, wow, like, they're seeing something. They see that I still sell tickets. I still, you know, sell merch. I still have this hardcore fan base. And I feel like they saw something special in that and were like, no, like, you can like do this. And this isn't like the last.
It's not too late.
Yeah, it's not too late.
Did you have a backup plan?
Yeah. Like, were you working a day job?
No.
Yeah. Like, if the nibbles hadn't come, you're in your late 20s and you're having this existential crisis.
Yeah.
Where did you envision yourself at 35 at that point, where you're just like, I'll get a square job, I'm going to...
Not even a square job. I think I was interested in moving into like like maybe like taking classes. I feel like I'm like too old to go back to school in a way, and also I hate school. I'm very bad at school. My grades were horrendous in high school. I was like, I dropped out of college after a year. I didn't drop out. I failed out. They were like, please do not ever come back. We do not want to see you.
They were like, we don't know her.
Be gone. Yeah. But I thought about maybe going to school or getting into like clothing. I really love clothes. I love making clothes.
You made these boots.
Oh yeah.
Tell us about. Yeah, I think it was really good.
Mud boots.
Yeah.
I actually made some that I sold on my web store, like handmade, but I'm trying to figure out how to like manufacture them for real.
Mm-hmm.
But they're inspired by the Kate Moss muddy wellies that she wore. They were just boots that were actually covered in mud that she wore at Glastonbury. Yep.
That picture went diamond.
Triple platinum.
Diamond on Tumblr.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about Tumblr. That's
probably a lot.
Probably a lot. That was big for all of us.
Yeah.
You mentioned yourself in high school. I have to just read your best tweet, which I think has come true. I'm living proof that even the Cookie Monster pajama pants girl from high school can make something of herself.
Oh, yeah.
If you don't know what the Cookie Monster pajama pants girl in high school archetype is, you do, or you went to a private school.
Yes.
Certain private schools.
Can you just expound on that a little bit? What were you like in this moment that you're referring to in this tweet?
I switched schools. I went to a Catholic school until eighth grade. And then my family, I kind of went for free and my family couldn't afford to send me to like a private high school. So I switched to public school.
Mm-hmm.
Game changer. So grateful. Thank God. Freshman, sophomore year was a bit of a nerd. I had braces. I was like, you know, I just like wasn't very cool. But like my friends that I like linked up with immediately were like these two like gay guys and this girl, and we would just like smoke weed. Like once I started smoking weed and got my braces off, I was just like a little rat, you know, like I felt the need to be very rebellious, but I also hated school. I hated chemistry. I hated biology. I loved choir and I loved English. Those were my favorite subjects. The only classes I ever got like decent grades in, were like art class, so like painting, anything creative. But later in high school, like I guess like junior, senior year, I became friends with all these like skater boys and we would all just hang out and like go to afters. It was very like my music video Beat Up Chanel's, that like filthy house scene.
Yeah, I was gonna mention that. Yeah, Beat Up Chanel's.
That was my life to
achieve. Comes with this video where you're surrounded by
boys.
Dirtbag boys.
Yeah.
John was like, this is Euphoria-esque.
Yeah. That's St. Louis. That truly is St. Louis in a nutshell. I would always have like one like hot female friend. I wasn't like hot in high school or anything. So I'd have like one like hot female friend who would be like fucking one of the skater guys. And we would go and it would just be like sitting around. There's like people are doing dabs and like you want to keep up. So you're like, yeah, I'll do one. And then you're like sitting there in psychosis because you're like, why did I just do that? Everyone hates me. Oh my God. So that was very the high school experience.
I mean, your music has a house party energy to it.
Yeah.
I feel like you're tapping into this idea of youthful rebellion. It's a little bit tongue in cheek. You have silly rapped lyrics sometimes, but also you use the same package to tell deeper stories. You know, I think of a song like Gas Station on this album, which is about your relationship with your father. Can you talk a little bit about what it's like to use that aesthetic to tell something deeper and truer about yourself?
It felt very natural and easy to pull from life experiences rather than make everything so mood boarded. I think that in music, there's become this kind of like era culture with albums, which is great. And I love a good, you know, themed thing, but I think with this project, like, it's not an Americana album. It's not like that aesthetic. I kept using references of things that like have either happened to me, memories that I have of like scenes, like the scene of In Beat Up Chanel's with all the boys, like that's genuinely like a play on what it would actually look like to go to like an after party in St. Louis where we would like stay up till the sun comes up and we're all just like smoking weed and listening to whatever indie band of that time. So I think that it just felt natural to kind of have that be the aesthetic rather than Pinterest mood boarding like vibes, I guess, you know? There's so much, even like the bunnies and the bunny man. My mom, her like, her, you know, women of a certain age love to have like a focus animal in their home.
Oh, wow.
You know?
Wow.
Do you know what I'm
true.
Saying?
Wow.
I never heard it phrased that way, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
Focus that's animal. That's overwhelmingly accurate.
Yeah.
That's so specific.
It could be a
so
chicken.
Yeah, no, literally.
I know an animal. I know an elephant woman.
My grandma loved elephants.
Oh my God.
She had elephants.
My great grandmother had literally, I'm talking like 100 elephants of different materials and sizes, and some were like this tall and some were like tiny, and then we had
Christmas auntie's like, I saw this in a shop and I thought and it's like an ugly little elephant ceramic.
Oh, keep going. You just blew our minds with that. please
so
keep
intense.
Going
so my mother's favorite is bunnies, and so I think a lot with this album, it's almost like this culmination of all these things from my childhood and all these memories I have, and putting it into a visual landscape in a way where it's almost like you're having a bad dream and you're remembering things wrong, where it's not like a little bunny lamp or a bunny ceramic, it's like a creepy bunny man in the corner of the room. There's a lot of symbolism in all these videos, and I haven't really talked too much about all of it, but it feels like a bad dream and remembering things from your past or your childhood, or even with the dance video, I think it's like the most cliche like form of like a pop video you could have is like the LED floor, full choreo and like the rain scene. But I wanted to do it in a way where it's like you're like dreaming about these things. You're maybe remembering it a little bit wrong. Something's a little off about it all. I love the kind of like visual that feels like a bit of like a strange nightmare. That's what I love about like David Lynch films. It's like a bad dream, but not because it's scary. Something's just a little off.
Because it's real. Like it's so close
to American uncanny.
Yeah. I'm pretty interested in this era of your life, your high school era. You're talking so much about real lived experience. I know the internet had to be heavy for you also at the same point.
Oh, yeah.
So IRL versus URL at that moment in your life. What are you doing in real life, and then what are you doing online?
I was heavily on Tumblr. Yeah. I feel like in high school, it felt like such a cool thing to curate like a blog or curate visuals. That honestly felt like my introduction to curating visuals and curating like mood boards. Or
it
like
made you a visual thinker.
Yeah.
Everyone was a creative director. Everyone was creative directing.
That's how we met.
It's true. John discovered me on Tumblr.
Really? Yeah. Were you Tumblr famous?
No.
Oh.
I had some hits.
Yeah.
Each had good taste.
Greatest hits album.
Yeah. There was a big New York City media Tumblr moment when I was in college, and it was mixing all the generations of New York writers and creators and photographers and videographers and musicians. Like this is before ASAP Mob blows up and Odd Future. And like, there was a lot of energy there, and there was a scene of writers.
That's very interesting. I think the internet is so vast now. Mm-hmm. You don't really have that anymore.
No, you don't have these little community corners.
Little pockets of Discord. Maybe.
Private internet.
Yeah, you can find it.
But not public internet
but
stuff.
It feels like everyone is also like famous now in a way. In a weird, everyone's famous, so nobody is at the same time.
But what were you doing on Tumblr other than and reblogging pictures of Kate Moss?
I would do like photo shoots with my friends. Mm-hmm. My friend Jasmine from home just sent me, because like she saw an interview where I was talking about something, and she sent me this like photo shoot that we did in my backyard where like she had on like a Sublime t-shirt and I like styled it, and we all had like ombre hair. Like I remember I had purple hair, and we would stylize imagery. They weren't like great. Like I wasn't a good photographer.
Digital cameras, are we talking? Or
I would like borrow friends like nice. Honestly, at my high school, film. Like we would like borrow.
Take
we would
from,
like
the AV club.
We would like take the camera and be like, we're gonna take that home for the day, we'll like give it back tomorrow. And we would like make imagery for Tumblr, so it felt like a creative exercise. So I'd make like GIFs or whatever with like things flashing in them. Like it kind of started my love to create visuals.
Do you think in that way you understood Slater, the character, as a visual enterprise before you fully understood what Slater, the character, was as a musical enterprise?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I always loved music and wanted to make music, but that's not always an easy thing to do. Yeah. I didn't really understand how to, especially in high school. I would always try, like I would find beats and I would like record over them. I would post like covers on SoundCloud. You know, I didn't know anyone with like a microphone or anything like that. So, but it really would start with the visuals, where I've always been a very like internet, chronically online, visually focused person. Like even before I started making music, I would do these like MacBook photo like sets, and I'd put them on Twitter, and I would like curate my outfit. I would do it when I would get home from my job, and it would all be like stylized. And it's such a random, like low hanging, like fruit type of like visual to make. But I would like curate my MacBook webcam photos to like look cool and use a different background. And they would be like kind of themed. And then, so when I started making music as Slater, and it, you know, it took on kind of like this like pink, bubbly, like Y2K Britney Spears life. The visuals were such a heavy part, even when they were at their most cheap, like webcam photo version, you know?
When you're finding people and you're like, I think we are similar, what were you bonding with them over?
A lot of music lovers and people on Tumblr who loved music. I remember on my Tumblr, or like even on Twitter, there would be like a lot of like random straight guys that would follow me. Probably because they'd be like, oh, like she like posts like hot pictures, blah, blah, blah. But then we would like have these like group chats and we'd talk about music. And sometimes they would show me stuff that I've never heard of or seen before. Like the first time I heard of Death Grips was like a Tumblr friend who was like, oh, this stuff is so crazy. And I was like, whoa, this is really crazy. Like, I love this. And I feel like Death Grips was really big on Tumblr, honestly, back during that
time. Is
that true?
Not on my Tumblr, but that's wild to know that Death Grips was popping on
it
Tumblr.
It felt like it was like kind of in like the straight boy music fan.
Yeah. It came out of like 4chan, like 4chan music, I guess that makes Fantano, sense. We're all like early Fantano.
Punching themselves in the head.
Yeah, that was good stuff. That's a little after our time. But that makes sense. I'm curious, as you move towards recording with a major label, you get signed by two veteran record executives in Ron Perry at Columbia and Barry Weiss of Records. Barry is somebody who worked with Britney early in her career in sync. A lot of the pop that is influential to you came out of these guys and their contemporaries. Mm-hmm. What kind of things were they telling you about what this album should be in order for you to change your career fortunes, and how much of that advice were you taking or ignoring?
To be honest, and I think why my partnership with them and everyone at Columbia has been so outstanding, no one ever really tried to tell me to change anything. I think the advice would be more about strategy. Mm. You know, I remember early on, there was like a call that they made that was like such a good call. And obviously as an artist, you're like, I want this to be the first single. But I originally wanted Dance to be the first single. And I think Barry and a couple of other people were like, oh, we really think it should be Beat Up Chanel's, blah, blah, blah. I love all the music like so equally that I was like, you know what? Okay, like, yeah, we could start with Beat Up Chanel's. I think you're right. It introduces this world a little bit better. And it's like kind of both the hard rap and the soft pop on one song. And not all the songs are like that. They can be either or. So yeah, let's do that. What an amazing call that was. Like, I think they just softened me up to like rethinking strategy. And, you know, I think artists, a lot of times, like, you want to be so like, it's only about the art. Like, I don't care about the marketing or like the, like, whatever, but it does matter now. If you have the luxury to like, not worry about that or care, then like, good for you. But,
but like, you've been toiling away just doing the music and not even having the opportunity to reach millions of people.
Yeah.
So I feel like maybe you're more open at this stage of your life and career to the idea that there is business and strategy, and that can be valid as well. Is that fair?
You're resistant to that? If someone had offered you similar advice on the last album, would you have been much more hostile to that at that time?
I think I listened to people a little too much.
Oh, the opposite. Like, you were a little pliant.
I think out of insecurity, when people would tell me like, oh no, this song is really good, you should put that out, I would listen to people and let people talk me into things, not really on the label side, just like everyone or even like friends. Like, it's not really like, I don't want to like blame anyone on like label side or not, but it's more just like other people's opinions I would take
as more valuable than yours.
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah.
I didn't really feel confident in my own abilities. And I was like, well, I don't, like, everyone must know more than me. Everyone must know better or whatever. And it led to a lot of output that, like, I, you know?
How do you look back on Starfucker? Like, how do you look back on that era? And if you could distill down what you think the dominant musical shift between that and the new album.
And even the previous album, Troubled Paradise.
Yeah. Well, Troubled Paradise, what a disaster visually that. I don't want to, you know what? I want to be careful not to speak negatively about anything from the past, because I do have fans who like love some of the older stuff so much. And I know it kind of like hurts their feelings a little bit, because sure. They're like, if you don't like, I love it, why don't you like it? Like, and that makes me sad, because I don't want them to think I'm like, you know, I don't know. I don't want to turn
us
around.
Too.
Yeah. You know,
but we apologize.
I think there's bits and pieces throughout every album that you can find on Worst Girl in America, where whether it's like, on like Troubled Paradise, Self-Destruct, it's like this very like trappy industrial, like I feel like I scream for the first time in that song.
The Slater scream has become a thing.
The Slater scream.
Whenever you're ready, we'll just lower the volume.
But I think Starfucker, that era, I really love that album. I think that there were definitely some plays made trying to maybe appeal more commercially, or look at what big music on the radio was sounding like and being like, I want to try to fit this box rather than draw a box of my own.
And let them come to you.
And let them come to me. Because that's a scary thing to do, especially, you know, like I said, like when you don't have a lot going for you and you're kind of struggling, like you want to move in a way where it's like, I don't have a backup plan. I don't have like a rich family, or like I don't have like any hits to my name at all. Like I don't have, I'm like struggling to pay my rent. Like I need something to click and to do somewhere. So you're going to want to be a little more commercial, a little more palatable. And a lot of the music on Starfucker, there's like songs that I think are so cool still, like Erotic Electronica or like I Love Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Things are a little more on the nose than I would maybe do now or right now. But it was my first time being very DIY with like directing. Like I directed a couple of the videos with my friend Kate for the first time. So that felt like our first trials of making visuals together, and that all led in like this album could not have come without the trial and error of that.
I mean, you opened for Charlie XCX like all the way back in 2019. Like, did you you just remembered? Did you feel like, oh, this is the one, like I'm out of here, this is my rocket ship, and you just missed?
No, I've never felt that way on like anything, honestly.
Okay.
Even with every project that maybe in the eyes of the general public would be like considered a flop, I still was steadily growing and like cultivating a fan base. There was never really like a crazy dip down or like fall off. Like Starfucker, I gained a lot of new listeners, a lot of new people. There was never like a moment where I was like, oh, like if I only did this, it would have all worked out. You start to tell yourself that, but I don't know. I don't like to make excuses for, I'm always just of the nature of like, I'm going to make something better and cooler and better sounding and something that taps more into, I just try to go deeper inside myself every time I make something, you know?
I'm Jonathan Knight, and I'm the general manager of New York Times Games. If you play our games, you probably know there's something a bit different about them. Just like there are writers behind the articles you read in the Times, there are creators behind our daily puzzles. Tracy Bennett curates the day's Wordle solution to keep it lively and varied. Wen Alu creates each connections board, including all those categories that try to stump you. Sam Mazursky combs through every last letter, word, and pangram in Spelling Bee so that loyal players of all skill levels enjoy it. Our puzzles are human-made every day with the standards you'd expect from the New York Times. And this matters because when you choose to spend time with our games, it should be time well spent, solving puzzles that are challenging, surprising, and joyful. Puzzles handcrafted for you. We think that's something worth investing in and something worth paying for.
Subscribe now for a special offer on all of our games at nytimes.com/joingames.
Obviously, we're here talking to you at like truly at a transitional moment and a breakout moment. But if that hadn't have happened, if the ascent had been steady but not spiky, and you were considered a cool cult pop star, you'd be happy.
Yeah, I mean,
you wouldn't. You're not living with this kind of like persistent anxiety in the back of your head of like, I'm trying to do this other thing and it's not hitting.
I think that with Starfucker, that is what was like, I think it was like wanting more success than I had too much. That is what harmed everything.
Mm, you wanted it too badly at that moment.
Yeah. And I never dreamed that even the bare minimum of attention on my music at all was possible. When I was like a hair salon receptionist and I got like 4,000 plays on SoundCloud, I was geeked. Like that was the major to me. So it's sad to me how the goalpost will keep shifting if you let it keep shifting.
Well, but now you've tasted it. So
now
what's the ceiling? Like how big do you want Slater to be?
I don't know. I just want to make things that I like love to making that I'm proud of. If things go bigger from here, then that's awesome. If everything stays right where it is, that's also great because this is so much more up than it was.
So it's the resources that you want creatively.
Yeah, which come a little easier the more successful you get, of course.
Sure.
And also there's an added layer of like, it's not even about me or what I want. Like, I don't want to let people down. Like all these incredible people at my label who work so hard, like I want to make them proud. I want to make them feel like everything was worth it. But I also want to keep like the center of all of it to be work that I'm proud of. You know, you get suggestions all the time as an artist where like people want to make the most of a moment or the most of a situation, or they want you to have a big hit, or they want you to do this or that. And I'm like at my age now, like age 29, I'm like very okay with saying no or being really firm and being like, no, I don't want to do it this way. Or if someone gives me pushback of like any kind of like visual, or though this isn't possible for the visual, I find a way to do it myself. I feel very scrappy. Even with like resources and budget, I am still so hands-on and like making costumes, and me and my friend Kate will like run and go shoot visuals in the middle of the night randomly. No set, no schedule, no like, no, you know, like just truly like on the fly. And I think if this all went away, I would still be like making videos or doing something and like putting just as much effort into it.
I feel like a lot of the things that you're referencing, we've talked about, obviously, the early to mid-2000s. We talked about like a much more unhinged version. We can go through the Kesha path and talk about what was happening there. I think contemporary pop, especially female-led pop, is in an interesting moment where you have people I would describe as kind of classicists, like an Olivia Rodrigo, I think is kind of a classicist. I think even Chapel in her own way is kind of a classicist.
What is a classicist?
Like someone like really interested in traditional pop songcraft, structure.
I thought you meant like classical music.
No,
like, really?
No. Although for some young people that might feel like classical music. But then you also, I think, have like really interesting, more dynamic, path-breaking things happening at the same time. And I wonder, when you look at this peer group, because I do think there's a peer group emerging. I'm not saying you're looking at it as competition, but you see the playing field. You see what works and what doesn't work. How do you think about that, especially when you look at kind of what else is out there?
Well, I think what works for people is like what is true to them and like true to their story. Mm. And I feel like what I have been doing with this project has been resonating because it is so true to me, and it is like natural for my voice to scream or do certain things, or the way that I sing all over this album. There's so many different styles and like accents, and like there's like moments where I'm like really like low register, low singing, and then there's kind of like Missouri tweaker twang where I'm like crank it, you know what I mean? There's so many different things where it's like I always want to keep it eccentric or just keep it myself, but you kind of see it time and time again where like when things feel so like copy paste commercial, an audience starts to draw away because it doesn't feel like what they fell in love with an artist over. Yeah. And that's why things that have like a bit more edge or a bit like things that feel a bit different to it do so well.
The pop songwriters who are writing the most number one hits, I think even they are bringing a little more edge in the last couple of years. Was there ever a push to get you in the studio with Amy Allen or, you know, these hit makers who are, I think, good at honing people's individuality, but also have their songs across 10 different people who are all over the radio. Like, were people trying to put you in those rooms?
Yeah, I did a session with Amy Allen. She's wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. I feel like I write in such a specific way that it's sometimes hard. Like this whole album, I didn't really work with any songwriters and I've tried to be like more open with it, but it is hard for me. I feel like I'm like a backseat driver with things a lot. And just like, I don't know, like my language, like I don't think anyone could like write crank but me in a way. but also like I have so much respect for, like, to me, like, I think like Sabrina Carpenter's project is so cool to me because it is like the most, it's so pop star, but it's also, it's just different from what I feel like.
Yeah, it's bespoke.
I've seen
pop.
Yeah.
It's idiosyncratic.
Yeah.
And it's so theatrical and it's so fun to watch. And the songs, like, oh my gosh, she has a major range where it's not just like, it doesn't have to be just like cheeky sexual music, but it can be, and that's fun, but it can be all these different things. I think she's like one of my favorite pop stars right now. I could do like a TED talk on why, like, she's not just like your typical, like, she does it in a different way. Mm-hmm. But it still feels like, it feels fresh, but it is like, you know, like Espresso is like one of the best songs I've ever heard in my life. You know what I mean? it's like a perfect pop song, but there's something about it that still feels different from the kind of formula that has been in place for like the past couple of years in a way.
Do you feel in part that's because when you get initial attention on the internet, you're getting attention long before a record label finds you, long before a manager finds you. And then you think, okay, I'm going to stand on this. Like, people liked me because I was this way. And that makes it harder later on to become something totally different. Because if a manager or a record label comes to you and says, maybe don't use the Missouri tweaker slang.
Yeah.
And you're just like, but actually, that's the only reason you're talking to me in the first place is because I was this person. Does that give the artist in your mind more leverage and therefore make for more idiosyncratic careers over time because you have this foundation where you are had to figure it out for yourself?
Yeah. I always come with like a pretty sound argument of like, if we try to like flip shit up and do something that feels too commercial, we're going to lose people that are responding to this because they like me and they like the way I do things, you know? As soon as you try to start rearranging things in the kitchen, you know, it's no good. So I feel like a lot of my music, like, it couldn't be, if those were songs pitched to another artist, like, they might not be able to like deliver it or have the same cadence or have
they
the same
sell it. Like, yeah. You can sell it.
But then there's a lot of songs that are like major hit songs that if you had me cut vocals on that, it would probably sound very strange and it wouldn't sound like a hit because I don't give to it what the artist that has it gives to it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
A couple singles in, I was like, I remember being so afraid of like being dropped. They weren't like, no one was like saying that, but in my head I was like, fuck, like, I was like kind of looking at the numbers and I was like, nothing's really like, cause it took a sec. Like, sure. I did a whole rollout and I think the album coming out as a whole, that's when things really started to,
When they could see the entire vision and then they could see you perform that vision, especially, and win people over. I think that's why we've seen in the last couple of years, like, Coachella be this launching place for when there's a lot of disparate fan energy and anticipation and curiosity. And then a stage like that, especially with live stream now, can really bring everyone together and it just explodes.
Yeah. Like, did you know the Coachella thing was happening as it was happening? Like, were you on stage? Because the thing about Coachella that I imagine must be frustrating for an artist, especially if you're not the end of the day headliner, you know, if you're playing in the middle of the day or in the evening, you kind of don't know. You're like, maybe 70% full, 30% full, 200% full. Yeah, you just kind of don't know because people are buying tickets for the festival. They're not necessarily buying tickets to come see any one person.
I mean, I definitely, something was in the air that day for sure. Almost like cosmically or like spiritually, because I almost feel like I blacked out during like that whole weekend one performance. I didn't realize how many people were actually like in that tent or that wasn't like normal for the time slot and whatnot. Cause I was the first set of the day.
I didn't realize you were the first set of the day.
I was the first set at that tent of the day. Yeah.
Wild.
So it was one of those things where, you know, I kind of like prepped myself in my mind where, you know, like, you're going on pretty early. People might not be even in the festival yet. Mm-hmm. Like, that's okay. This is such a milestone either way. And I'm actually so glad that I played so early because it made it that much more special that there was that crazy of a turnout.
Sure.
But to be honest, not until the very last song of the set, like Beat Up Chanel's, I think I took my in-ear out and I heard people singing back and I was like, so to hear that many voices, I was like shocked. It didn't really register, but usually when I get off stage, I have like 1,000 like crazy anal notes about like, oh man, I missed that one note and blah, blah, blah. Like, I come immediately every time I get off stage, I'm always like, fuck this up, fuck that up. And everyone could be like, you did so great. And I'll be like, no, it was shitty. I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. But this was the first time I like walked off stage and I just like, my friend Anna, who also like was tour managing me that day, I collapsed into her arms and I just was sobbing and I was just like, we did it. Like,
you felt it.
Yeah. You know, I was crying like, oh my gosh, all after. I was like in the car. Me and my friend Kate have been kind of filming, just like behind the scenes stuff here and there. We're trying to like document like everything right now as things are happening. And she has this video of me and I'm like sobbing. And I'm like, I thought it was over for me like a year or so ago. I can't believe this. I love you guys. Just because my whole team, I've been with all these people for so long and it's not just about me. It was like a win for all of us, you know?
I want to talk a little bit about the versatility of your sound and how many sort of different spaces it can feel adjacent to. I think you're probably the only person on the planet who has collaborated with both Pussy Riot and Aisha Erotica. Aisha Erotica, an artist that we don't talk about enough, candidly.
Oh,
like,
absolutely,
like,
yeah.
Like truly one of the great unheralded or little less heralded musicians in the late 2010s. Like just so important. You collaborated with her very early on in your career. Tell me a little bit about what is it about what you're doing that makes it compatible with a wide range of potential collaborators and actual collaborators.
I think my own musical output feels very like a squashing of so many different things that I feel like it can lend itself to different things in different styles.
I did have this thought watching your performance on Fallon where I was thinking, oh, if I was a kid and I saw this, and it's pretty pure pop, that performance, that's right? It's very Britney.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
You were saying, like on purpose. And if I then went and I, from when I was a kid, bought a Slater CD and I put it on and I heard Crank or Beat Up Chanel's or something else, I was like, oh, I wonder if someone who discovers Slater through this performance would be disappointed. And then I was like, no, 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 you're thinking like an old person. I was like, imagine being that kid and that and buying something because of the single and then pressing play and having your mind blown and learning about all this other stuff. So I think hopefully I would imagine your pure pop stuff is a little bit of like a gateway drug for people to learn about more abrasive or less commercial music. Is that true to you?
Yeah.
Is that
absolutely
why you chose to do that song on Fallon as opposed to Beat Up Chanel's? Or?
Well, I think that it's having a bit of like a moment on TikTok.
Madison Beer did the dance, right?
Yeah.
Kyle MacLachlan did the dance.
Yeah.
You mentioned David Lynch.
It's like the, oh my God. Yeah, I like that actually really was like so crazy because like Blue Velvet is one of my favorite movies ever of all time. And I love him. I love everything he posts on social media. He's such a G. I like love him, but yeah.
He's really going hard.
Yeah.
Really
yeah. Like, he is like, he just loves music.
Is he cashing a lot of label checks or is he just
love
music?
I think he just loves music.
I need the investigation. I
need
your P&Ls for your dance every TikTok.
I think he's tapped in.
Or his social media manager stepped in at least.
I think he just loves stuff.
Loves it. Love of the game.
We alluded along the way to some of your forebears, you know, obviously there's Britney, but Kesha, who you toured with.
I love Kesha.
Like these women who are a generation or two removed from you in the pop star lineage, but have been through similar paths of, you know, I'm indie, I'm pop, I'm major label, I'm underground, I'm a queer favorite on the internet versus I'm a mainstream star. Like, have you spoken to either of them or someone else on that path specifically about this moment that you're in now?
Not really. I always feel like I'm like bothering people, but it's funny. I've been chatting with like Courtney Love a lot. She's been offering me a lot of advice about things and she's so cool. I loved Hole. I still love Hole, but like when I was in high school, I wrote like my senior like English paper. The only thing I've ever gotten a good grade on was about Courtney Love and like rebellion in the music industry and Hole and everything with that. So I think, kind of full circle and crazy, but
how did you guys get connected?
She posted something with my Coachella set on Instagram and I was like, oh my God. And I DM'd her and she was so friendly and nice. And just like, I gave her my number and she's like the fucking coolest. She's the fucking coolest. And I feel like she is also someone who very finger on the pulse. Like she like keeps up with a lot of people, keeps up with a lot of like younger artists, small artists, and like new bands, everything. And it's interesting to like kind of pick her brain on what she thinks and likes about certain music, what she doesn't like, but she's rad. Yeah.
Should we hit a couple questions in our lightning round?
I'd love to.
Yeah.
52 cards in the podcast deck. Every card corresponds to a pre-written question. Why don't you pull a couple? We'll see where this takes us.
Are you going
to
do a magic trick?
Woo. No, I don't know any magic.
This entire show is a magic trick.
Yeah. What do you got?
The Queen of Spades.
What do you do on a long flight?
I actually have like written songs on planes. Like if I have like an instrumental that's like missing a verse, I'll like write music.
Like NoTap style, or
NoTap
like
style. Yeah.
Be listening
headphones
to the demo and
yeah. Mm-hmm. I like to like get creative stuff done on flights because like it is like a nice time that like you don't have to really do anything and like you have time. So sometimes I'll get together like a video treatment. I've like mm-hmm. done a lot of work. I do a lot of work on planes of just like video stuff or writing.
If you don't have any work to get done, you're gonna fire up a TV show or a movie. Are you going to watch something you've seen before? Are you going to go comfort, or are you going to try to catch up on stuff?
Something I've seen before. Yeah. Something I've seen before but haven't seen in a long time. That's okay. Always a fun watch for a flight because okay. You're like, oh, I forgot about this, you know?
Anything good recently you watched on a plane?
I haven't watched a movie on a flight in a really long time.
Too busy.
Last movie, you know, it's funny. I always talk about this being like my favorite movie ever. Last movie I watched on a flight was Uptown Girls.
Brittany Murphy.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The closing track of your album.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why that movie? What about it?
Oh my gosh.
Connects with you.
It was my comfort movie when I was a little girl. And I think when you become an adult and rewatch it, it takes on a new meaning. But it seems from the surface like it would be some kind of like just early 2000s rom-com, but it is such a sad movie about growing up or like losing a parent or like not having a parent, feeling like you're kind of like an adult child that like can't figure it out. And it's such a beautiful movie. And it makes everyone I show it to that hasn't seen it, I'm like, they like always cry. It's great.
Pull another card.
Seven of Diamonds. What's your go-to YouTube video to show someone?
I love like Outdoor Boys. Do you guys know what that is?
Oh yeah.
What's Outdoor?
Tell the people about Outdoor Boys.
So there's this guy and he like builds igloos and like camps and it's like a really awesome watch. It's a good thing to fall asleep to. But
Outdoor Boys.
He'll like make bread and like he'll like fish and then like make the fish. And he just like films himself and he'll like, go to all different places.
It's one guy?
It's one guy. Sometimes he'll have like other people involved with the camping.
We're going to do some research.
Yeah, we're going to do this up.
All right, pull two more cards. We'll see if we can get something to really upset you.
Damn. Okay. Wait, the queen is...
Queen of Diamonds, King of Hearts.
I'll ask them in a robust order.
I feel like you're just going to like make one up and like...
No. I mean, I can just give you
the rules.
Good,
always follow the rules. Rule followers.
We do follow the rules. Queen of Diamonds. Okay, you asked for it.
All right.
What's your biggest weakness as an artist?
Honestly, probably I have like crippling ADHD mm-hmm. to the point where it's really hard to function sometimes. I think just as like a normal member of society. Like my house is always like there's clothes and fucking rhinestones and bullshit everywhere. I'm not a very together. I'm not a very like with it like person. Like I'm kind of always like woo.
But
which is why
I
love Uptown Girls. I relate to the like the free spiritedness. I'm just kind of like, you know, I take it a day at a time and I'm just like, I'm living and I'm vibing.
But you think your art might be better or your career might be better if you could tighten some of that up?
Career, yes. Art, no.
Okay.
What can make your art better?
Digging a little deeper on the next go around. I think this was a very personal album, but I think I can push it a little further. I think pushing everything a little further. It's not even about like improving art. I think it's just for my next go around. I just want to attack things through a different lens or like in a different way. Or even like expanding on the sounds that I've made and just exploring things that are different.
Mm-hmm. You've been teasing a little bit from the studio. It seems like you're making companion pieces to your existing songs. Do you want to talk a little bit about what's next?
Yeah, I think there's something really funny about in music. I feel like people, or even like any kind of like art, film, anything, people always talk about how they're like, the sequel's never as good as the original, blah, blah, blah. And I've been really kind of wanting to like fight against that and like make something that feels almost like a sister or brother album, if you will, that is an expansion on what came before it, but something completely new music that feel linked to the things that came before, even like titles being inverses.
So not a remix album, but a sequel in some sense.
Yeah, which people used to do that a lot. I feel like albums, like The Fame is one of my favorite albums mm-hmm. ever. The Fame Monster was like 8 new songs and it was kind of an expansion or like a sister album where she didn't completely switch gears so fully, but it felt like an expansion of 8 new songs and then they were kind of tied together. Same with like Born to Die or Paradise. Like that mm-hmm. used to be a big thing. I don't know if that was like a deal, like an album deal structure that used to be a thing in like 2009.
That's an interesting, it's funny because I think so many of these decisions that are presented, I think especially the young fans, is kind of creative decisions.
Even they're actually, they're business
decisions. Yeah. Like they're,
that's like kind of an old school deal.
That's what I'm saying.
It's just,
I mean, the album itself is a business decision. It's like, oh, we have more space on the record now. Let's fill both sides.
Yeah. But it's been kind of fun to like think about like the evil twin of like what this album might be.
Last question, King of Hearts. Where do your best ideas come to you creatively?
I love being alone. I really love to be alone. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of good ideas come late at night when I'm like by myself in my room, in my bedroom.
Good that's luck
like
with where that. My As music you get more famous. That's going to be tougher.
I'll find time.
Okay.
Yeah, even if I need to step outside, I always like
slam the door and people say, sleep.
No, not even like that. I just I'm like a creature that thrives with solitude. So I think I need sometimes even if I'm in like a crowded bar, I'll be like, oh, like I'm gonna go smoke and I'll like walk around the block because I like need a sec. Yeah.
Introvert recharge time.
Yeah.
Every episode of Popcast ends with a snack test. You came in and picked a pair of snacks, really after my own heart. These are hers, Buffalo Blue Cheese Puffs. This is...
Oh, it's not even a chip.
It's a puff.
It's a cheese doodle.
It's a hers.
Don't say that with so much disdain.
Cheese
it's a cheese doodle.
The hers term is curls. Cheese curls. I cannot wait to eat these.
I guess they don't own the trademark on doodle.
This is already my favorite food. And then you picked the pickle flavored sour straws. Pickle flavor, really hot in candy right now.
Why?
We did those
pickles are huge. Hey, pickles are huge right now.
Pickles are huge.
But tell why? The label. Like, pickles are fucking pickles huge.
You
right
enjoy,
now.
Like, huge. You enjoy pickles on their own.
I love pickles.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Pickle
so we're going to go, are we going to go savory sweet or you want to?
Is that even sweet?
I mean, I don't know. Yeah. Where do you want to start?
I think we should start with dinner and finish with dessert.
Okay.
How am I supposed to know the difference between those two things?
I'm going
to
bust open these cheese curls. Oh, yeah.
No.
You like blue cheese, John?
No.
You like buffalo wings?
I'm a
sensitive boy.
I'm a disgusting eater with a sensitive stomach.
With a sensitive stomach?
And palate.
And apparently every guest that we have loves those flavor profiles.
Oh, we're not supposed to eat them?
No, go nuts. Do whatever you
want.
You want
another one?
Oh, that's lovely.
You want to have more?
No, I'm okay. Those are great, though.
Not that lovely, apparently.
Oh.
All right.
So good.
Buffalo.
I can't believe I brought these in. I should have just kept them for myself.
Oh, my God. They're
rancid. I can't
believe
I'm going to share.
They're literally rancid.
They're so good. They're so good.
Don't be too good for the cheese doodle. They're good. They're great.
So the blue cheese hits first, right?
I don't taste any blue cheese.
Really? I taste the cheese first and then the buffalo at the end. Mm.
Oh, man.
That's a perfect snack.
Do you not like junk food?
No, I live for junk food. You happen to pick like.
That's why we do this on the show because we both love junk food. But John just
you have a limit.
Has a limit.
It tastes like respectfully.
The limit for me. I'll
respectfully,
eat like
it tastes like an Applebee's.
Yeah, Applebee's. Yeah,
sorry.
I would love complimentary. Would love to go to Applebee's. Wait, you were telling us about a St. Louis specific snack.
Red Hot Riplets.
What is that?
It is a spicy barbecue chip, and it's like a St. Louis snack. There's a lot of like St. Louis little foods and things that are really great.
Okay.
Will you mail us one?
Yeah, we need.
Yeah, I will.
We need somebody. Oh, somebody from St. Louis. If there's anyone listening from St. Louis, send us Red Hot Riplets and we'll eat them with a future guest.
They're really great. There's this bar in St. Louis that crushes them on macaroni and cheese.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Speaking of crushing, I'm going to crush this entire bag as soon as this taping is
all right,
over.
You're coming around. I'm struggling here because.
But you're coming around.
Like, my gut reaction to this is highly negative, and yet I'm just like. I could house this.
Yeah. Come on. So yes, that's the answer. Let's get those sour straws going. Yeah. I need another mix. John, you love buffalo.
Don't tell anyone.
You love blue cheese.
Those
don't tell
amazing.
My Italian American family. Jeez.
All right, we're going pickle. We're going pickle now. The pickle.
Why are there two different ones?
Yeah, the pickle sour straws have both a yellow and a green variety.
Yeah, what's the difference?
I don't know.
I guess we'll find out.
Are you a sour straws person in general?
I do. I like
this is among my favorites. It's in my top five for sure.
I'm not a huge candy eater in general.
We should take all right one of these.
Strong pickle smell.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh Christ.
Oh wow. Oh, wow.
Which one did you eat first?
I ate them both together.
Mm. No, you don't want to differentiate?
Nope.
Lawless.
I have something wrong with me because this is good.
It's
like, to
so
me.
Good.
I'm not a picky eater at all. I like it.
Wait, but literally, what's the difference between the two? I'll start with one.
It's just the branding that's turning you off. Because if this was like an artisanal candy and they were like, it's a dill flavored sour.
Oh, the pickle hits right at the end on that one. Oh my God.
It almost has like a black licorice vibe at the end.
Interesting.
I don't know if I'm rocking with this.
One thing about sour straws, you just never know how stale they're going to be. That's like that's a law of New York City bodegas, is like you might just get the stale sour straws, but it's like, to me, it's a feature, not a bug.
Yeah.
It's a little bit, it's like Russian roulette with your sour straws. These are crispy, I would say.
Yeah.
They're like very hard to chew.
The yellow's exactly the same,
yeah,
too.
I think they're the same. But I think it's delicious.
Is my resolve weakening in my old
age? You're coming around to all these
you
snacks.
You like it?
Kind of like
you're
it.
You're just picky. You're not. It's not that you don't like this stuff. You're just picky.
Do you not like pickles?
In your brain.
No, I don't like pickles.
Not see, in your palate.
The sign of a picky eater. If you don't like blue cheese or pickles, you're picky.
What about mustard?
I've come around to mustard.
There we go.
You didn't like mustard, though?
No, as a kid. No, not at all. But I now can tolerate it. This is, you know what it is? The violence of the pickle aftertaste. Like the late violence in this. Mm-hmm. The sourness is so loud up front that it kind of mitigates the violence of the pickleness. And in general, you have warmed me up to sour treats. I didn't really eat sour gummies.
Yeah.
Okay. I wouldn't choose this.
Sure.
But I'm not mad at it.
Sure.
Okay. Let's have some ratings out of 10.
Yeah.
First, the cheese curls.
10 out of 10.
10 out of 10.
10 out of 10.
11 out of 10.
Yeah.
Guys, okay. Chill.
That might be a new fave. That might be a new fave.
New fave, for sure. Would order in bulk.
Oh, fine. It's a 7. Let's have some restraint here. Okay. And the pickle sour straws.
I would give that like a 4.5.
Wow.
You're low.
Wow, okay.
Maybe a 5. I wouldn't revisit that. It's a little unnecessary.
Yeah, it's more of a gimmick than it is an actual flavor, but I'm still going like 6.97, you know? It's right on the border of
we're freaking
excellence.
Two decimal places now? That's a first. We've never had two decimal places.
I meant 6.9 or 7, not 6.9.
Like an album review, you're like giving
me
the point.
Yeah, pitchforked it.
But it's like on the verge of a 7.
Yeah, it's a 6. I expected it to be a 2. Mm-hmm. So congratulations to this candy company for triumph over the 2. That is our show, Slater. Incredible
to
have you.
Out.
Thank you for being here.
Come
Thank
back
you
anytime.
Guys. Thank Very, you for having me.
No, it's a
You're
joy.
An easy hang.
Yeah, yeah. Like,
thank you.
Seriously.
You guys are an easy hang.
Sharp, self-aware, sees the vision, gets it.
Ah. Congratulations.
Yes.
Keep
congratulations.
Going.
Thank you guys so much.
Every episode of Popcast is at nytimes.com/popcast. You can find us on YouTube at youtube.com/what?
You said popcast.
Because the sour straws are like ruining the back of
change.
The top of
they
my
They made
hand.
You British.
Yeah, they really like there's something they're activating that's screwing with me. We're on Instagram and TikTok. We're out. We're listening to Aisha Erotica demos on the internet. Find us anywhere that
Tumblr.
You find us. Yeah, find We're gonna do a podcast Tumblr. We're gonna make a podcast Tumblr.
For
we're
you.
Bringing it back.
Should.
We've been teasing,
back.
But we're really gonna do it.
No, we're really doing
back.
It.
Get back on.
Find us in all those places. We'll be back next week.